I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Shot Podcast. This week, we're joined by Grace and a very cute-looking little puppy, I think, that she has in her arms. Welcome,
it's
Grace.
It's a cat.
It's a cat. Oh, my God. I need to get new prescriptions. My glasses, clearly. Oh, it's a big cat, though. Like, it's a massively huge cat. So that's why one was confused. Grace is actually joining us, my God, from her home in Hobart. Who would have guessed?
G'day.
And also with us from NAM, Melbourne, is Dave Milner, editor of The Shot. Hello, Dave.
G'day, Joe. G'day, Grace.
Charles is not G'day. With us. He's off being high-powered, shooting a pilot for his new TV show, which is pretty exciting, that he will be unleashed again, potentially, on our screen sometime in the near future. We shall look forward to that. But in the meantime, further things to discuss. Dave, you wrote, I think, a piercing, poignant piece for The Shot last week on The Voice, and indeed the issues in our educational system that may be leading to some of the confusion about The Shot, if not the misinformation about it.
About The Shot or about The Voice?
About The Voice. I think The Shot has its own issues, but probably they're not referenced that much in our education system.
Not yet, anyway.
All three of the issues for The Shot are sitting right here talking to you today.
One of them is shooting a pilot, I think, let's be fair.
I guess I did write that piece. And
it seemed to resonate, I have to say. I think people were really pleased to hear all of it articulated in, as you say, some of the kind of the fuzziness that exists around the cognitive dissonance, I think was the term that you used, in relation to being a white man in this country seeking to have some kind of justice, if not reparations, for our First Nations brothers and sisters.
Yeah, and it was very much just my own perspective. I feel like I can't really speak on anyone else's perspective on this one. So, you know, that's why I took that approach. And I just realized I really was, you know, despite knowing better, factually I was carrying these two versions of history around in my head. And, you know, I obviously know all the facts, but I also realized that when, you know, studying like what happened in, you know, North America, South America, Latin America, basically the entire world, I had a clearer version of the violence for what was happening over there. I understood the brutal horror of colonization. It was here. I still had this fuzzy notion that it was a bit better here, that it was Australian, that it was friendlier, that it was cricket and barbecues. And, you know, this version of events, while also having studied in detail the massacre map of Aboriginal, you know, frontier violence, and just trying to reconcile what that was. And then I thought about the ways in which I was educated as a younger person, not just at school, you know, through popular culture and the media and whatnot, and just writing about, you know, that experience, what this very Eurocentric narrative foundation myth that we are taught. And that was the part that seemed to resonate with a lot of people. I had a lot of people on Twitter saying, I'm 80, I'm 60, I'm 50, I'm 40. And I learned this. And I got to a point in my life when I was, you know, defensive about my whiteness. And instead, I just decided to learn this. And now I feel much better personally because, you know, that's not what this is about. This is a trap that stupid, angry people fall into and thinking that, you know, they can't actually just own this and be okay. It was really interesting. It was actually, it's one of those topics that I feel like not enough people here talk about, that it feels a bit fuzzy. You're not really sure until you hear someone else say, yes, this is what it was like for me too. This is what that feels like. So yeah, it was really interesting to see that reaction on Twitter. A lot of crazy people telling me that I am a self-hating beta cock that doesn't like my own tribe as well. That was fun.
So you're both younger than me. When you were growing up, so Grace, you're the youngest here. It has really only been, I would say, in the last sort of 15 years in particular that those massacre maps, with the level of detail that we now see and know and are learning about, were being formed through academia. The University of Newcastle, Lyndall Ryan was doing a lot of work in that area and really going through and documenting the oral histories about what happened and where it happened and the extent of the massacres and the violence and the kind of cavalier way that Aboriginal people in particular were being dehumanised. Did you learn about that at school, or was that something that you had to educate yourself about as you kind of became an adult?
I didn't learn about it in school so blatantly. The term quite literally would be whitewashed.
Yeah.
I think certainly in primary school. So I went to the first 3 years of my education, kinder, prep and grade one, I was at a little, I guess you would call it like a Steiner school in Hobart, or just on the eastern shore of Hobart. And there was actually quite a heavy focus on Aboriginal culture. And I remember learning about Dreamtime. I remember when we went on excursions, what was incorporated in the teachings even then, when we went, to certain locations, we would learn about Aboriginal culture, which was really quite interesting when I look back on that time, because I can remember things even in, even in grade one and prep. And we went to, Arana Camp, which is down near a place called Roches Beach, which is actually near where I grew up. So the beach over from Roches Beach, where I go running quite regularly across Roches Beach and into Seven Mile Beach, which is where I grew up. My father still lives there. And learning about Aboriginal culture then, but certainly not at that age where we introduced, for probably good reason, into the darker side of history. And in high school, there was some talk of it. However, I learned a very honest history through both of my parents who, although separated when I was 2 years old, very similar in terms of their philosophies. Neither of them are very ideological people, but they're very open-minded people. They're both avid readers, and they pass that down to me. And they're both open to sort of talking about any kind of honest history. I mean, I was listening to Archie Roach when I was like just walking. Charcoal Lane was an album that my dad would always play, and so, you know, I was listening to Took the Children Away. I was learning about the Stolen Generation through music first, and then through the conversations that came from that, and so through that, you know, learning about that and from listening to Paul Kelly. From listening to
this
Paul
is
Kelly.
So true for so many Australians that artists in popular culture have filled in the gaps that our education system has lacked. I feel like, you know, Midnight Oil explained this to a lot of people, Yothu Yindi, etc.
And so it was through the real teachers who should have been teaching us actually, and perhaps not the. I mean, I didn't have a single Aboriginal teacher in school, so there's that as well. So arguably, I don't know if I would have wanted to hear those lessons from anybody else other than an Aboriginal themselves. And so
the lessons can definitely be improved, though. I remember it was very much we were made aware of Aboriginal culture, and we talked about Dreamtime myths, and we talked about, you know, didgeridoos and boomerangs. We did those things. But it was all through a sort of a really paternalistic lens. And I remember...
Very rose-tinted.
But it was also, you know, kind of... It was still punching down. It was like, yes, the Europeans bought booze and smallpox, and the Indigenous people just couldn't hack booze and smallpox kind of... It was a really strange, this is their fault sort of thing. They lacked the constitution to handle their piss and their smallpox, which is just a ridiculous framing.
Well, yeah, and
so we were made aware of it at the same time. The lens that's the framework on it is still justifying these little things ever so subtly. It's justifying taking children away, even though it's not actively doing that in the way it's, you know, what it's stating by this point. It's that the language and the framing around it is still a little bit, well, they might have needed this. That's the implication. And that was basically my education until, you know, sort of in the 90s, I guess.
It's even, I mean, even the kind of the framing of it as, yes, the smallpox came and, my God, those they had such weak constitutions that it was rife and so on, isn't dealing with the fact that, you know, there were violent wars taking place.
Yeah, yeah. That's just never mentioned.
And it's so interesting talking about artists and the way that there's this, you know, I don't know if you watched The Frontier or The Australian Wars, about The Frontier Wars, which is Rachel Perkins' really stunning documentary, which is available on SBS On Demand, which I really recommend that you will watch, because it goes through in really quite forensic detail. It, you know, it chooses particular geographic regions and you know, the strategy that went into the wars on both sides. And she discovered for the first time that, you know, her descendants had been caught up in it. Her grandmother or great-great-grandmother had been, you know, raped and murdered as part of, not murdered, but raped. She couldn't have been murdered because, anyway, they had been caught up very much in the violence. And Stephen Page as well, and his Who Do You Think You Are, that was just on SBS 2 weeks ago, found out that his great-great-great-grandmother was one of the sole survivors of a massacre that took place on north of Stradbroke Island. You've kind of have now our artists and our storytellers uncovering, you know, what happened in their own families and bringing a really personal kind of engagement with these, you know, terrible, you know, origin stories of our nation to us in their kind of very eloquent way. So, but it is interesting. And even now, as you say, Dave, you're kind of copying this sort of, you're a self-hating white man, when all you're doing is articulating what we know now to be completely true and being very honest and vulnerable about the kind of the dissonance and the confusion that that creates for you.
I feel like it's more helpful to be, you know, honest at this point. This is a turning point moment for the nation. And I feel like bad faith, disingenuous actors are trying to make it more complicated and to confuse it. It's very much just a question of recognizing the truth in our constitution. It is the factual truth, and I don't think anyone should have a problem with that. And it's also about, you know, do we want to start listening to our Indigenous people on matters that concern them? End of. That's basically the question. And all this, I mean, Peter Dutton, I touched on it very briefly. I didn't want to give Peter Dutton too much of my time, because I don't think anyone should give Peter Dutton too much of their time. But the whole idea of the Canberra voice, this, you know, it's like he's trying on catchphrases, seeing which one will stick. It's very, you know, it's very Trumpian. But it's the idea that having an Indigenous lobby with a direct line to Parliament and that being undemocratic, given all the other fuckers that have got direct lines to Parliament, you know, at PwC, for example.
I think the difference, Dina though, Reinhardt, and I, look, whoever. I take that argument, and that the fundamental truth is that we have a kind of an anti-democratic system which has developed through the access that we, as a matter of course, give a lot of the corporate actors, and particularly the fossil fuel industry, but not exclusively the fossil fuel industry. I think there is, though, a difference here, because this is not just giving an open door, and indeed a revolving door, from within corporate world to the ministerial offices and the prime ministerial office. It is about embedding it within the constitution. And, you know, we don't, however we may act, the fossil fuel industry don't have an embedded constitutional right to the access that they've been gifted by our political leaders. I know it feels like it, but they don't. So there is a difference, but I think the difference is
completely... They have it embedded in the earth.
Yeah, no. Well, that's true. But I think the real difference is that, you know, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples are our Indigenous peoples. And there is, it is entirely appropriate that our founding document recognises that, as the High Court now has, that their terra nullius does not exist, and yet that isn't reflected in our constitution. And it should be. And so whenever, you know, even Warren Mundine, when he doesn't make much sense, but, you know, the thing that he said when he was first embarking on his self-promoting campaign on for the no vote was, well, then let's have all of the various groups that have migrated here recognised in the Constitution as well. And then all those groups that have migrated here said, no thanks, Warren, we're supporting The Voice. But again, not recognising that there is a fundamental and important foundational distinction between recognising Indigenous peoples who were here first and all of these other groups that have access already. And also, of course, the reason that we need to embed it in the Constitution, apart from the fact that it's right, is that what we've seen time and time again through history is that if we don't embed it in the Constitution, then for base political reasons, as soon as new governments are elected, they will get rid of The Voice, which has been established. And that's happened with all of the councils, advisory councils, that have been in, like, have been formed and established from, you know, Holt onward. So if you don't have any kind of consistency and continuity and any guarantees that The Voice, that an advisory body will continue to exist and will be listened to, then, you know, what's the point? And I think that's what we've seen in Australian contemporary political history. Yeah.
So the question then becomes, you know, a matter of strategy for the Yes campaign, what do we need to do better?
Well, you know, I was at an event, a Crikey event last night, bless Crikey, which was basically information and celebration of the demise of Lachlan Murdoch's defamation case against them.
Was that a big night, Joe? Was that a fun party to be at?
It was a lot of fun. I mean, it was really interesting to hear just, I mean, everything that we'd sort of known, but to hear it. Will Hayward, the CEO of Private Media, the parent company of Crikey, kind of gave an introduction that just sort of set out, you know, event by event, what had happened to get us from the point of, you know, Bernard Keane writing something which, as he said, had been written by many others across particularly the US media. But clearly Lachlan, who is thin-skinned, as we know, decided to sue a small publishing company in Australia to take advantage of our outrageously plaintiff-slanted defamation laws. So he thought that he could kind of make some point using the Australian defamation laws that he could then sort of extrapolate internationally. But, you know, as Will said, like when Crikey decided to take a stand and put the letter in the open letter in the New York Times saying, go on then sue us, that he would think that the best response is to actually take them up on that and sue them, really demonstrates there is, yeah, there is a dearth of perhaps strategic thinking going on in Lachlan's brain.
Yeah, he's no Logan Roy.
No, he's like, I don't know which, yeah, anyway, we won't get into succession and Murdoch analogies just at the moment. But what Malcolm Turnbull was saying really is that, and he spoke from.
Wait, so Malcolm Turnbull was there too?
Malcolm Turnbull was on the panel.
This is so funny. I was up till 2 a.m. playing Diablo 4 with my girlfriend, and you're at a fancy event talking about the future of media. This is very professional of you, Joe.
I'm at fancy professional events every night of the week, Dave, let me assure you. But what he was saying, and speaking from bitter personal experience, is the difficulty of actually passing referenda in this country. Now, we all know that, but, you know, it was salutary to be reminded of that by someone who had put so much on the line for the Republic referendum back in the day, in the, what was that, the 80s or the 90s? It's all a blur.
90s, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it's all a blur now. But by having to get the majority of people and the majority of people in the majority of states, that's where it gets difficult. So we have to carry three states at least, and then we have to get the majority overall. So, and the ACT and the Northern Territory, they only count in the national vote, so getting the kind of absolute majority at a national level of voters, but then that these three states. You know, obviously The Voice has to carry New South Wales and it has to carry Victoria, otherwise it's doomed.
Yeah.
Have to carry one, at least one, of Western Australia, Queensland and Tasmania, and it will South Australia. And, you know, South Australia, it could be the pivotal vote. Tasmania is an ageing population, but it's small. So, you know, you don't have to. That's why people like, you know, Jackie Lambie and Tammy Tyrrell and Brian Harradine back in the day can keep getting elected because they don't have to get, you know, many actual votes. So, you know, Tasmania could be tricky. Queensland, I think people are probably writing off. Western Australia, you know, even the retirement of Mark McGowan is being considered as perhaps an event which will make things harder, but who knows? I mean,
Gina Rinehart winning Western Australian of the Year.
You'd have to think that was parody, and then it was real. It's like, God. So I don't have the stats. I mean, obviously the trajectory of the opinion polls is not great. You do have to think there needs to be some kind of disruptive event to ensure that we don't continue on a downward trajectory, because otherwise we'd kind of run out of time. But by the time we hit October,
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The 14th, I think that's the Saturday, that's the date which it's most likely to be. We could have run out of time. So
who's at the forefront of the Yes campaign? Who's the loudest, most likely to cut through to the people they need to cut through to carry this vote?
Well, I don't think that it's one single person. I mean, I think I'm kind of pinning my hopes on the fact that there are many people working in many different communities. So in that sense, it's using some of the strategies of the community independence, so engaging at a grassroots level. If you go to the Yes 23 website, you'll see that happening all the time, all of these different events, information sessions, conversations going on in literally, you know, every corner of the country. It is, you know, all of the merchandise, every, like, T-shirts, core flutes, badges, everything has sold out on the site. So Thomas Mayo and Kerry O'Brien's handbook is sitting at number 2 on the bestseller list at the moment. I think there is a real appetite for, well, did I say this last week? I've been going out and buying multiple copies, so ordering lots, getting them in gradually, and then going around and putting them in all my little libraries around the area. So being like the true book ninja. So because people
So do you own lots of little libraries? What does this mean?
You know, little libraries that exist around in the suburbs. Do you have them?
Oh, the little take a book, leave a book kind of thing.
I've been going and putting the handbook in all of the libraries in my general area.
I love that. That's cool.
It's so that people can then kind of, you know, and they are like, I've been watching, I go back and like, as I was riding past one of them where I put one the day before, I saw someone actually just walking past casually and then do a double take and come back. And I like to think that was because they decided to pick up the voice handbook.
Doing good deeds.
There is clearly an appetite for information about it. And, you know, it's well organised in the sense that, you know, there's Australians for Constitutional Change, which Danny Gilbert from Gilbert and Tobin, Rachel Perkins, they're co-chairing. Obviously the working group through Megan Davis is out there. I know that Marcia Langton's going to have a big piece in the first edition of Meanjin under Esther Anatolidis' new editorship, which is going through individually and taking apart a lot of the arguments that people like Dutton have been disingenuously, cynically making. So, you know, I think there is a lot happening. I think that the campaign is generally excited about the prospect of it leaving Canberra, where it, you know, the debate has all been taking place in Canberra at the moment because the referendum enabling legislation had to be passed. And that's where, you know, when Malcolm Turnbull came out yesterday and said, I think also wrongly, but that's another whole conversation, that the No campaign hadn't necessarily been lying to date. They'd just been being hyperbolic with some of their claims. And then on cue, when I got home from the event and was looking online at the, you know, various news sites, the dissenting report from the opposition members into from the parliamentary inquiry into The Voice had been released, and they had out and out lied and misrepresented what Justice Hain and Chief Justice French had said when providing their evidence to the inquiry, to the extent that they had essentially diametrically opposed positions and attributed them back to French and Hain. So, you know, there is so much bad faith happening in this debate at the moment from that side, from the No side.
Can I just point out, so we've got some really wonderful Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voices, you know, that are contributing a lot of material. So whether it's Nessa Temple Roberts or Teela Reid, you know, and we should be listening to, generally speaking, or whether it's whoever it is expressing their opinions on this. But and call me a cynic, you know, and I was asked, for example, earlier in the year to write a piece around the 26th of January, and you know, I thought about it, and eventually I didn't. I just didn't, because I just thought, you know, it doesn't matter what I say. It doesn't matter how many of my Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander friends I talk to, and it doesn't matter the level of due diligence and care and time, research. It doesn't matter at the end of the day. On both sides, or however many actually nuanced, you know, multi-directional angles are put forth in this quote-unquote debate as we move towards a referendum, I would love to know what percentage of these opinion pieces, of these, you know, whatever you want to call them, are actually being presented by white Australians on behalf of, a lot of the time, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, regardless of what side they're presenting. I just want to know.
Two things I would say to that. I think that on the No side, you know, that's why they keep wheeling out Warren Mundine and Jacinta Price, because they're the only Aboriginal people of any profile that are, you know, prepared to prosecute the No case.
That's fine. But when it comes to people like, you know, like, you know, I remember at the end of last year, sort of, you know, I was on Q&A, and it sort of like, it doesn't matter if you're whatever sort of side you're presenting. And I think I was sort of, the point I was making was not to make any kind of point any which way or other. And that is like that the most important thing is to listen to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders on this particular issue, and that sort of still seems to be missed, you know, by who under whose authority is Malcolm Turnbull saying that, you know.
The only one thing I will quickly say before I hand to Dave is that in this particular instance, as opposed to Australia Day, we do have to persuade, like, the majority of white Australians to support this.
The more you listen, the more you realise you need to listen, and you need to just keep listening.
I mean, as a white person that's, you know, weighed in on this now, I guess, you know, about a month before this, I caught up with a mate who is an Indigenous person, and we drank, and, you know, a reporter, I won't say who, and had beers, and I talked about it, and I asked him these questions, because I was, you know, racked with, you know, do I jump in? And his take was very much, fucking oaf you do, because we actually need help, you know, need allyship, need people pointing out the disingenuous nature. And the fact is that, yes, you're a white person with quite a large platform. That's a responsibility. Use it properly. Like, don't shirk the responsibility. Help was kind of the sentiment that I got.
But what are we doing? What are we doing to actually create space for these Indigenous voices or for these Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander voices to come in and lead the way rather than saying, rather than being, oh, well, I'm a white person and I need to talk to you as a white person because it's only white people that will be listened to. That's the paternalism that I am seeing. So it's like, what about, you know, like I'm seeing, for example, and it's brilliant to see people like Nessa Turnbull Roberts who's coming forward and who's actually saying things like, these things aren't past, these are present. You know, she's a survivor of it, of the recent stolen generation sort of model, and she is coming forward and being a leader. So rather than saying, oh, you know, I've got to talk to you because I'm a white person, and so like, what, you know, like you can only take it from me because you don't. It's almost sort of saying like,
but if you vacate
the
space. It's only bad actors speaking to white Australia.
Well, I think that is a dangerous thought. But they're also saying it can't only be left to us because actually, as we've just seen with Stan Grant, like the emotional kind of pressure and the weight of always having to be the people, like a lot of, you know, Aboriginal journalists in particular have been saying, you know, as this debate is happening, they're all these big institutions are turning to us and expecting us to be the ones that always step forward and explain, you know, like Tony Armstrong is a sports presenter and yet has had to take on so much of the emotional heft and doing that labour of explaining again and again to white Australia why it is that these issues are important or why it is that Aboriginal people are feeling particularly vulnerable through this debate and so on. So I'd absolutely take your point, Grace, and I think that the space needs to be made. And I think we have got all these fantastically eloquent, erudite Aboriginal voices coming forward in this debate. But as Dave says, I think we do still need to be the loud allies that are going to be necessary to get this referendum carried.
It needs to be both. I guess it's sort of like it's a fine line to walk because it isn't that we're not supporting. It's like there's the difference between, I guess, the advocacy, the solidarity, the being it's the walking alongside as opposed to walking above and holding power over. It's that the power together, and that's a really hard line to walk because you'll find that with these disingenuous no campaigners or whatever the angle is, the campaigners that are out to get you will always find a way to detract. They'll always find a way to reduce, and that sort of just like learning that this sort of networked abuse, which is really exacerbated in this time of the you know, not just the internet. I mean, the internet's been around for a long time now, but with certain tools that allow that what the internet already gives us to be worsened. It's really important to keep that in mind because we can very easily forget, I think, especially because, it's human nature to fall prey to, and this is not about victimhood, this is sort of like we take on board criticism because we want to improve, we want to find ways to, better our causes and things like that. So it's really easy to, get sucked into sort of the traps that are sort of set. To know that there is that out there, it is tough stuff. Cause like I see it as well, like in what I do, that it's that damned if you do, damned if you don't sort of principle.
Well, I think in this instance, tough. I think what we have to remember is what the actual Uluru Statement from the Heart said, which was at its heart, it was an invitation. And, you know, the statement ends by saying, we invite you to walk with us in a movement of Australian people for a better future. And I think that's where we all have to take up that invitation with enthusiasm and energy and kind of get out there and do what we can because, as we know it's a big job.
I think people that, you know, want a more inclusive, more truthful Australia should feel emboldened to say that
and to support. And I understand there is a little bit of a, it's kind of, do you know what? I get the whole stay in your lane thing, and I do get that. It's sort of a little bit about how I felt reporting on some of the sexual harassment and the sexual assault stuff in Parliament House. I was a little bit like, I'm a white dude. I really don't think I should say anything right now. That's like going through the back of my brain a lot of the time. And I'm sure there are people that maybe feel a little bit uncomfortable about, you know, talking about The Voice because they're white people. And I do think key to that is just all the stuff Grace has been touching on about listening and respect, but like really listening. At the same time, like the reality of this is a nationwide referenda, and it's a conceptual nightmare that the numbers game is that white Australia gets to decide this, but that is the fact of the matter, and white Australia needs to be spoken to, and obviously by Indigenous voices. But you know, there's this horrible thing about the way racism and culture works is that white Australia will instinctively be listening to white Australia, and if it's only racist, disingenuous voices in this space, then you know we're going to need a lot of luck.
And it is where, you know, with the same-sex plebiscite, which obviously was a different standard anyway, although would have in fact passed had it been a referendum. Most white Australians will know a gay person. They may be related to one, they may be in their friendship group. You know, there is something about that touches them quite directly. Whereas not all Australians, not all white Australians will know personally Indigenous people. And that, I think, allows there to be more distance created and to the debates to become more abstract and more cerebral and actually less personal and intimate and emotional and foundational. And I think that's the challenge, but hopefully a challenge that our country is finally up for, because, you know, we are one of the few, if not the only, I think, Western country, colonial country, that does not and has not recognised the colonial truth.
It is the only.
Yeah, in our constitution, and has not kind of made peace and negotiated a treaty with Indigenous peoples. And so to have brought forward the discussion, had the debate, and then decided to reject doing so would be a real stain. And, you know, as Noel Pearson said, it would set back the cause of reconciliation decades, generations.
It would. It'd be crushing. I think people realise this.
But yeah, I would hope not going to happen.
It's hard, and it's what I say when I am talking about the issue that, that sort of it defines the space that I work in, and that is that, you know, we have to, as much as we possibly can, refrain from looking at things through the lens of ideology, whatever that ideology is, whether it's, you know, some kind of political ideology, or, you know, a religious ideology. You know, it's about looking at things through a human lens, literally just looking at each other as if we're human beings. And it's really, especially when the media, you know, the mainstream media has so many agendas, and the media is built on, has been built on for a very long time, a very adversarial lens. And that's sort of what I guess frustrates me about what Malcolm Turnbull says, you know, that it is, regardless of, you know, like even take the vitriol side of things away, it, like the fact that it's divided into yes and no is in of itself disingenuous. Of course, it's going to be much more nuanced than that. Like things are inherently human. We are human beings, you know, and this is actually quite a spiritual issue. I mean, again, I can't speak on behalf of any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders, but they're spiritual people, and we're trying to make this, we're trying to fit it into a political system. And, you know, so to look at each other, just, you know, and if you want a lesson on humanity, I mean, you know, get it from a child, like, you know, get it from an uncorrupted. So just try to take those, if we have to, you know, to take that away, all of these different sort of And it's because like the kaleidoscope just keeps shifting and shifting and shifting, and there's all these different agendas, and every outlet, no matter sort of how independent they are, I mean, you've got to ask yourself, like, what's their aim? And it is to, it's to sell a paper. It's to have a point of difference as well. And sometimes, you know, like the further along we get in these debates and you see all these different sort of things being put across, often it's because, oh, well, that point hasn't been made before. And it's not actually serving any other purpose other than to contribute a different point of view. And it's not actually therefore serving the people at all. And so we have to get it back to the people.
We do. And as I say, I think that now that the referendum enabling legislation has been passed, I think the Yes campaign is very much hoping that it does now kind of leave the febrile environment of Canberra and go back to community, because it is going to be a long time. It's going to feel like a very long time between now and October 14. So Godspeed to everyone out there campaigning. And on that note, I think we will thank you for your attention for the last half an hour or so. Do look out for this week's...
Joe, can I mention one thing?
Dave is going to jump in as I was segueing neatly into my wind-up.
It was so neat, and I love that I messed that up for you. I just wanted to mention, last year I did like a charity push-up thing and I'm doing it again this year.
Oh my God. So
check my Twitter, please, and like donate. It will give money to Lifeline, which is a very good
place. You're doing lots of push-ups?
Yeah, I'm going to have to do 210 push-ups today. I did 160 yesterday.
In one day?
It's all regulated. Yeah, you have to do like more than 3,000 across the month.
So
I will be in lots of pain.
Yeah.
If that amuses you, send some money to... Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
The details will be on my Twitter, thanks.
Well, we can hear about how kind of sore Dave's muscles are next week. Look forward to that. Look forward to hearing of the push-up count. Look forward to hearing about Charles's pilot. Look forward to coming back next week.
And shout out to Lifeline. I've made a few calls to Lifeline this year. They're very handy when you're traveling and you don't have a therapist.
Yeah. So they need all the money that they can get from Dave's push-ups and beyond. See ya.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.